Ever since the High Middle Ages in Europe, theology was associated with scholasticism and higher learning. It even came to be known as the Queen of Sciences. Whatever that ultimately means, it hints at the fact that theology embraces the historian, philosopher, linguist, interpreter of texts, both ancient and modern, to borrow from a statement by William Wood, Oxford lecturer in philosophical theology. Since the Middle Ages, though, well, theology has had a rocky road, especially in public perception. It is occasionally, perhaps even often, that people experience theological ideas through the lens of the fiction they consume, which risks doing damage to complex ideas, oversimplifying and even strawmanning. Philosophy itself hasn't had it much better. An article I read today suggested that both theology and philosophy departments are increasingly irrelevant. I think it's important, however, to recognize that these branches of study, theology and Sophia, once considered twins, aren't really so irrelevant, and that asking questions of whys and what fors are as valid as the hows and whats of the physical sciences. This is MageCast, episode 42. A coincidental number, am I right? And we're of course talking about Xenogears, the JRPG released by Square in 1998 for the PlayStation. This episode is unique not merely because we're going to talk about so many big ideas and big questions in the realm of theology and philosophy, as well as subjects like the evolution of art, but it's also special because it is actually another podcast in disguise. The Bookworm Games podcast invited me as a guest to discuss these very things, and the host, Wesley Shantz, has graciously permitted me to republish the episode through MageCast. You can find more conversation along the lines of the one you're about to hear by checking out links for Bookworm Games in the description for this episode. Now, I've never actually played Xenogears, but I think the conversation which we had is inviting, friendly, and in many ways inclusive, which I think many spiritual or religious conversations today can and should be like. So, whatever your personal views or whether you've played the original Xenogears or not, I hope you find some encouragement or inspiration from this episode and that it gets the Xenogears turning. Here's Wesley.
Hey, welcome to Bookworm Games. This is Wesley Shantz, and I'm joined this time by Moses, the well-read mage Norton, from the blog of the same name. How are you doing, Moses?
I'm doing very great. Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. This is an exciting conversation that I think we're going to have tonight.
I've been looking forward to talking to you in person, so to speak, for a long time. Because, you know, I came across your website, I don't know, a year or two ago now when I was working on a series of essays and thinking about Earthbound a lot. And I made it into a podcast. And I was like, okay, so now what do I do with all this stuff? So I was looking around, and that's how I came across thewellreadmage.com. At the time, it was a WordPress, I guess, and now it's its own sort of thing, still powered by WordPress. But I was just so delighted to run across your work and what you're up to there. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about how you got started with that and some of the stages along your way with the blog and your reporting and thinking on games.
Sure, it'd be my pleasure. So The Well-Read Mage is the third blog that I've made. The first one was a theology blog that I put together based on notes from a college-age systematic theology group that I was teaching for about 2 years. And then after that, I made an extremely short-lived comic book review blog called Briffits and Quimps. Briffits, I think, are like those little dash lines in comic art or cartoonist art. And then quimps, I think, are the, if I remember right, like the Saturn celestial shapes when somebody cusses in a comic or gets hurt or something like that. So that didn't last long. I quickly realized I couldn't afford to buy enough comic books to warrant reviewing them. So after that, I had a couple of friends who we were all kind of talking about blogging. One of these friends kind of was dabbling in a movie review blog. And I was like, why don't we just make a blog together? So me and two friends who ended up being the Black Humor Mage and the Timely Mage decided to start this blog, and we were just going to write game reviews and game thoughts. And eventually other real life friends that I knew locally wanted to join. And I kind of did a little bit of evangelizing to them to see if they would want to write for the the site.
Yeah.
And then I think it was somewhat out of the blue, somebody I'd never met online asked if they could write an article for the site too.
Yeah.
And now we have over 60 registered writers. Now, not all of them are active, but they're all around the globe and they come and go and they write when they please and there's no quota. But it's been cool to be able to kind of express all these different opinions and publish different opinions, even though those that I disagree with, because I think that's important for game review sites to not create like ideologically slanted or even just material that's all slanted in the same critical direction. So,
no, yeah, I really appreciate the breadth of things that are possible there. It's not just reviews too, which is great, because I don't really write, you know, straightforward reviews. I write my take on games, and the kinds of things I'm interested in are a little weird, I think. And it's cool that there's a place for that also.
So, yeah. So
thank you very much for hosting and being sort of the master of ceremonies.
Yeah, it's really been awesome to, you know, I've never met you in real life. This is the closest that we've ever met before, just talking over the internet. But it's great that there are people who come that will latch on to the ideas of, you know, criticism can actually happen, yeah, or it's important to share a variety of different views and have that kind of diversity. And to create new kinds of game writing. So we do primarily reviews, like you pointed out, but we also do feature a lot of different other kinds of content. We're growing kind of a family of podcasts. We've got a podcast network that we're leading. And we do, you know, the columns that you've done as well. Opinion pieces, editorials, all these different kinds of things. So it's been fun, though.
Yeah, collaborating in that way is, I mean, it's really important, I think, to not for me at least, to not just feel like I'm sort of talking to myself all the time, to feel like there is somebody on the other end who can give me some feedback and set me straight if I go off, you know, on some weird tangent sometimes. And I think that's another really important part of those other things that you're kind of interested in. Like you said, this was, I guess, the third most recent foray into doing this sort of thing online. I'm curious how you kind of learned from or, you know, developed it out of those other projects on theology and then on comic books. Like, what's the through line there?
That's kind of a question that I've tried to sort out over the years. I think that the ideas that are core to the Well-Read Mage stem from some of my core beliefs about the current habitat, if you like, of theological discussion. So I think what we've seen historically is a lot of closed-mindedness, a lot of sectarianism, and a lot of ad hominem in discussions about theology. So one of my purposes in writing about those things and in teaching those things was not just an attempt to make them more accessible. And when we talk about things like God's aseity, like what the heck is that? But so to introduce these ideas to an intelligent group of people, the college age, and not just to make them accessible, but to make them something that can be discussed in an environment where attacks are not tolerated, where free discussion can happen. I think that that's important in the realm of theology, but I think that that's important generally as well. Perhaps you could say even historically, gaming discussion has had a lot of similarities with theological discussion, in that there is, again, sectarianism, there are groups, there are fandoms that can get pretty extreme. sometimes. So sometimes I woefully think I'm not the right personality for that ideal, because I like to argue. But I think that trying to promote the kinds of principles that make ideas more accessible and that make discussion more capable is something that I really believe in, whether I'm the right person equipped to make that happen or not.
Hey, I mean, it's going so far so good as far as I can tell. And that's the third new word you've taught me tonight. I got to say, what were they about the comic books? The Brifflets?
Oh, and Brifflets quimps. And quimps. Yeah.
And now aseity. Aseity is the self-existence of God. I had to Google it. I don't know that word, but I do now.
Yeah.
I feel like you're doing something right.
Well, cool. Hey, you're one of the smartest people I know based on your writing. So that's awesome. But it demonstrates that we have so much to teach each other.
Yes.
Have a lot to teach me. I have a lot to learn from other people. And that cannot happen unless we're having conversation.
Yeah. Well, I feel like there's a lot in that because, you know, the thing that lets us discuss, as you point out, right, the internet is this wonderful thing. We can find out things immediately that we didn't know before, and we can meet new people who are far away and have, you know, similar interests, but different backgrounds or, you know, different knowledge sets, skill sets, whatever. But by the same token, it's this, you know, horrible machine that is this kind of echo chamber effect. And any small argument can quickly, you know, blow up out of all proportion to whatever it was actually about in the first place. And so how do you get to have such a good, you know, healthy community? Is it, I feel like you have some wisdom on this that you are being too humble about right now. How did you get this thing to work?
I really don't have any particular wisdom on that. I don't hand select people. There's very few people that I've reached out to personally and asked if they would like to write for the site. My belief on that is that communities will attract the kind of people who really belong there automatically. And so I think that the people who have come to the Well-Read Mage, and not necessarily just written for it, but supported it in a variety of different ways, whether that's financially or through conversation or through content, or for just being there and asking questions and interacting, that those are the kind of people that believe kind of a lot of the same core ideas. And so, I don't know, maybe I think it's more like a beacon than it is like I have some kind of mastermind blueprint that that does things that, you know, I don't understand how it works. It's, we're going to be, I think it's 4 years old in February. And if you told me 4 years ago that this site was going to be like this, I probably wouldn't have believed you. I typically am afraid of talking for prolonged periods of time, but here in the past 10 years, I've had the opportunity to teach people in groups settings, and then I've had the opportunity to write and to start podcasts. So I don't know. It just happens. Stuff just happens. I don't know how. I don't know.
I like that. Yeah, it's a wonderful place. And so if people out there haven't, you know, really spent much time there, please, you know, you're more than welcome to. And so as somebody, you know, starting a podcast or a blog or whatever it is, this is a great place to come in and soak in by osmosis or whatever mysterious means it is, you know, whatever you can learn from this. I wanted to dig in a little more into the theology component of your, what you were teaching, a systematic theology course at a certain time. How did you get interested in that as a topic? And what sorts of things were you trying to work out systematically or whatever that name, that term means? I'm not entirely sure.
Sure. So systematic theology is basically just an approach to examining what's historically considered like orthodox doctrine. And this, obviously, this could apply to a variety of different worldviews and religions. But for Judeo-Christian systematic theology, it's a question of what are sort of the basic beliefs? How do they arrive at those beliefs from the source material? And so on. So it's systematic in that it approaches these subjects in an orderly fashion. One of the things that I think is prevalent in religion today is an overemphasis on the passions, on emotions. Those things have a place, most certainly. But I think that a lot of knowledge has been lost in the public sphere of theological discussion and theological writings and knowledge that have happened in the past. So around the time I was interested in reading Aquinas and Augustine and a few other bizarre names, but it was something that I think was good for that period of time in my life and the lives of some of the students that I had. It's not something that I finished. I never entirely finished teaching systematic theology. I think we left off in like pneumatology or Christology or something like that. But we went essentially through the attributes of God. I learned about a few attributes of God that I hadn't heard before. Like what was one? Oh, like God's impassibility.
Whoa.
Yeah. Which doesn't mean that he can't be passed through. It actually means that he has no passion.
Okay.
And the term means that he can't suffer. And that raises all kinds of questions, right? Because then you have, what about the incarnation of Christ?
Yeah.
What about God experiencing grief from human sin? What about, you know, God taking no pleasure in the death of the wicked and all these things? So that's a really fascinating idea to explore. I think that was Aquinas that coined that phrase, but it's interesting. To me, it felt like trying to explore this concept of, you know, is what would the prime mover be? What would the unmoved mover be? I talked to a lot of agnostics who I empathize with greatly. When I was younger, I identified as an atheist. Oh, wow. And I think that it's a valid question to say, you know, let's just say that there probably is something out there, but how do you know anything about it? How could you possibly know anything about it? If it's so far removed from our experiences and what our life is like. And so I think part of that exploration of this concept is this idea of trying to go systematically through different reasonings and different argumentations and different writings and ideas and concepts and theories and models.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll ask people like, what is your model of God if you believe in God? And they'll have various different ideas. And so it's just, to me, it's an interesting and it's a fascinating subject.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I always was fascinated by theology, and I have dabbled in Aquinas and Augustine. The Confessions, I think, is one of the, you know, foundational works of literature and of theology for that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one thing that I try to encourage people, I mean, you know, I don't just talk to Christians, and I think that's an important thing. That's part of that echo chamber. Yeah. But I think that at the same time, people are turned off by relentless relentless proselytization.
Yeah.
But so in having a discussion with people, I'll talk about things like literary value. That's kind of a hard thing to quantify. But when you talk about books like Confessions, these are books that have helped shape civilization. You talk about books like the Bible, like there are still ideas that are core and central that have come out of the New Testament. one thing that I've been listening to recently, and it's something that I want to explore more. I've never studied it. I don't know, but I believe it was the New Testament scholar N.T. Wright who suggested that the first appearance of individual civil rights is in the New Testament in the ancient world, as far as equality for individuals. That's a pretty humongous claim, but it's something that I'd like to kind of explore more. So questions like that, discussions like that, that are happening now, I think that these things aren't, they haven't all been figured out entirely.
N.T. Wright is a beast of a writer. I've read a little bit of his many, many works. Yeah, he has an interesting point that he brings up from time to time that I'd like to get your take on. He says something about how very important it is to have a love for the subject in order to understand it. And he's, you know, talking in terms of faith, I think primarily, right, that you wouldn't understand faith from the outside, right, in the way that you would need to get that full, comprehension, which would be possible. And so I think there's something interesting there because, yeah, you can study and you can go through a lot of things logically or rationally or in an orderly way, but that there's some quality of experience that can't be gotten from an objective standpoint, but you have to sort of undergo it. I don't know if that's a fair representation of his point, but that's always how I've understood what he's saying about having a kind of hermeneutics of love or something like that. So what do you think of that? Does that jive with your take on being objective about things and standing back from them so as to understand them better?
I think that that's probably a pretty sound principle for almost any field of study. You imagine it'd probably be pretty hard to understand something from, say, like an empathetic perspective. Yeah. If you're utterly disdainful of it. But I think like in something like writing is a craft that I'm very much interested in. But imagine if I hated it, I probably wouldn't do much of it. And therefore I probably wouldn't get much, you know, practice of it and wouldn't improve at the craft. So I think that probably does apply to a lot of regions, a lot of fields of study. The second part of what you were saying there, as far as like an experiential understanding of something, in thinking about my own life, I had several experiences in which I quite nearly died that were part of my coming to appreciate the brevity of life. I think when we're young, we think we're immortal. And I certainly did when I was young, but I almost drowned. I had a kidney removed that was 50 pounds. So I've had some health issues through my life that in retrospect, I think were important for the development of my understanding of life from my perspective of life. But I don't think that somebody could have the same impact that those experiences gave me just looking at them from the outside. So I don't know if that approach is answering your question.
No, absolutely. Yeah. So here's a concrete example. I mean, that's really intense. But just to go to video games to lighten things up a little here.
Yeah.
Here's this game, Xenogears, that I've been talking about on my, you know, in my work for a little while now, where I'm trying to sort of delve into some of its literary sources and its themes, and they're all to do with you know, killing God and riding giant robots around and being really just really like full of life and gusto, and it's a wonderful game. But it's also got you know, these kinds of ideas that come to it through, as far as I can tell, through a certain kind of reading of religious texts and psychological, I don't know, studies, and mashing that together with a lot of, you know, anime and I suppose a certain amount of just sort of general Japanese culture. And so stuff that I'm a lot less familiar with. So I tend to focus on things that I know about a little more. So, you know, when I approach that game, I can see that there's, you know, a lot of objective flaws with all sorts of elements of it. You know, it's a bizarre mashup of a lot of weird stuff to begin with. And yet I really love the game, you know, and so that makes me want to spend time talking about and thinking about it. And I noticed that for you, it seems like your favorite game is also the game that you consider objectively the greatest game. I can't help but notice you like to talk about it in those terms. And it's Chrono Trigger, of course, right? For the SNES. Uh-huh. That is your favorite game, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great game. I think it is objectively got to be up there as far as the best games ever made. Certainly one of the best RPGs ever made, if not the best. And yet I wouldn't say it's my favorite game. I would say I like, you know, several, especially Earthbound. Earthbound is even more so than Xenogears. I am endlessly in awe of the enjoyment that Earthbound brings and the delight. And I don't know quite what to do with that, because I can see that, again, it's got some quirks to it. Like, it's not a perfect game the way Chrono Trigger is. So what is it about you, I guess, that makes you sort of those two things work together, the objective quality and the subjective favorite, you know, element? They go hand in hand with you.
Tremendous question. So it's a favorite subject of mine that people know. Sometimes I parody myself in creating objectivity exists memes and things like that. But I'm a firm believer that objectivity in art and subjectivity in art both exist. Objectivity as qualities in the object, subjectivity as observations from the subject. But I think so much more needs to continue to be said about that in the relatively young area of video games. Now, a couple sort of clarifications that I want to make is that I think you can have multiple best games ever, actually.
Good.
Because those things can exist in separate contexts. So it depends on the context that you're willing to explore. If you're going to say the best game of all time for all video games, like, do you mean the context of all video games yet to come? Because that seems pretty audacious. Yeah. Or do you mean, like, one of the things that I attempted to explore in this article that I wrote about Chrono Trigger that was compared to, like, a doctorate is this idea that Chrono Trigger, one of the things that makes Chrono Trigger great is its handling of its own hardware limitations. So things like there being no break between battles and exploring the map, and how the designers chose to handle that in interesting ways. So things like that I think are definitely approachable and understandable, but I don't think that we're anywhere near critically capable at this point in time of really understanding completely 100% objectively, you know, what's the best video game in this or that. Another clarification that I want to make too is that I think that a person's favorite and a game that they think is the best is frequently not the same thing. And it doesn't have to be the same thing. So I have played some video games that I think are incredible in terms of their objective design, their presentation, the craft of the performances, the utility of the visuals, and all of these things, the expert tightness of the composition of the music and so on and so forth, that are objectively, I think, really well put together, but they're nowhere near my favorite game. And that's for a variety of personal reasons.
Yeah,
so absolutely. I think that being able to, though, express what your reasons are for liking a game personally and being able to express what you think are really the good extant qualities in an object are two different things, but they might have some overlap. And I think that exploring that boundary between what is objective and what is subjective is absolutely fascinating. And I think the more that we talk about it, the better.
Yeah, yeah. So that you can sort of have the richness of the perspectives that cut across and overlap and yet aren't wholly aligned, so that you get both of those integrating in some way to make a larger whole of your appreciation of the game or whatever the work of art it might be. So yeah, for me, if I was gonna sort of say what I think the best game of all time is, I would say it's Super Mario 3.
Which I gave a perfect score to when I reviewed it. I think that, yeah, objectively it's quite good.
And the reason I would say is that feels more like a video game somehow. There's an element of RPGs which is more like a story, you know, and that in Super Nintendo games it's kind of limited because they didn't have the room to unfold the story in the way that you do once you get on CDs and discs and the cloud and whatnot, right? You can just go forever. But there was always more of an emphasis on narrative storytelling that, you know, through text. That's what I want to say. Whereas in Mario, you know, you're just doing stuff and there's this incredible verve to your jumping and running and flying and oh gosh, it's just the perfect game to me. And I think about Zelda in that way too, right? Some of the Zelda games, I couldn't pick the best one or even maybe my favorite one, maybe Majora's Mask. I don't know, but maybe Link to the Past. I think those are also perfect games. You know, I couldn't say anything that could be done to make those games better. And I think that there's something about the youth of a medium actually, or a genre, where the perfect definition of it comes out early on in its existence, because you see this in languages too, where, you know, in Homer's epics, they are like the definition of Greek literature in a lot of ways, and they're the first. And the same goes for you know, someone like Shakespeare, who kind of codifies the English language and coins lots of words and sort of defines for us what we think of as, you know, great English literature, and Dante in Italian. And I think that might be, I'm sure that somebody has, you know, said this better, but that might be a thing about a medium, that like in its infancy, it has its most perfect developments, and that it only is going to degenerate in different sorts of ways until it gives rise to something new.
No, I think that's fantastic. When it gives rise to something new, I think is when that context shifts.
Yeah.
So for instance, you know, you bring up Homer and Shakespeare and those things. Those aren't really like the standards necessarily by which we judge storytelling today, because they're so far removed linguistically, culturally, historically, and so on and so forth. There are things, I think there are artifacts of those works of art, those masterpieces, that are analogous to what we would explore today in terms of storytelling. But I think as time goes on, you know, new art forms are created and new sub art forms are created. So this was a discussion I was having with someone recently about the question of like, should we have stuck to sort of the rules of Renaissance art and just kind of kept those ideas and perpetuated those ideas? Well, then we never would have got Impressionism, right?
Oh, yeah.
But so you could see that, you know, new genres need to be created, new subgenres need to be created, and they contain their own rules then. we're able to, because of objectivity in art, we're able to pick out what is the difference between a Monet and a Rembrandt, because we can see what descriptions and what rules and what the playground has changed to. So in 20, 30 years, who knows what video games will look like? Who knows what new best video games we'll get, but I think that those best will exist in a specific context. So say, I agree with you though.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. I like that image. The art example is a good one because when I say degeneration, I don't mean that to be pejorative necessarily, because the thing is sort of coming apart the way that an impressionist painting breaks the light into little patches. Right. But, but that somehow in so doing, you do sort of learn a new way of seeing that you wouldn't have learned otherwise, and that's valuable. And that the work sort of teaches you how to look at it, and in turn teaches you how to see things in a new light. And I think that's when I look at Xenogears, so just to, I really do want to come around to this eventually. it's a mess of a game in a lot of ways. You never played it, have you?
I haven't, and thanks for bringing that. I was going to mention that on your show, that I've not played it.
Okay.
I'm very excited to play it someday, but I've not played it any longer than about 15 minutes.
Okay, so I won't, normally I'd spoil all sorts of things about the story, so I will not do that, and so don't listen to other episodes in the series if you don't want the story spoiled.
I appreciate that. You know, it's fair. I mean, the game's, 25 years old? Something like that?
Gosh. Yeah. So it's got a lot of brilliant ideas. It's got wonderful characters and relationships and you know, they're after the deepest meanings you could imagine, right, for a story to go after. But as a game, it's flawed in lots of ways, you know, and I think as a story too, it has its problems, its issues. But part of that is that it is reaching for something that's so extravagant that it really does break new ground, and in just the sort of way that, like, you know, a new artistic style emerges, and it's hard to understand at first. I don't want to go into specifics, but it's the kind of thing that I really admire in games. That in their flaws, you know, that they're trying something new, and they're creating something which otherwise would never have made it into the world. And it's not, you know, it's odd because they're coming out of Square, right? It's a Squaresoft game. It's got some of the same people who worked on Chrono Trigger, right? And you would think, like, they'd take that experience and work it up into something even greater and more, you know, amazing. And in some ways they do, and in some ways they can't, you know, they can't quite recapture that. There's a lot of limitations external to the game. If you read about it, you know, they kind of ran out of time and money, and the development just was like a nightmare in a lot of ways for the people that were working on it. But they, you know, at the same time, they pushed their talents, right, to confront those things. And I guess you see that too with Chrono Trigger, right, with the composer, Mitsuda, who works on both games. And you talk about this in your piece, I think. He has like a breakdown, right? Because he can't do it. He can't complete it.
He was overworking himself. Certainly, I've never been Japanese. I've never been to Japan, but it sounds like that's a cultural trait to be an extremely hard worker. And certainly, like most things in life, right, can be a vice or a virtue, depending on moderation. So it sounds like he was in his office for several days. He's sleeping in his office. He's just working constantly. Eventually developed ulcers, had to be hospitalized, which is quite traumatic. To what degree that affected the final quality of the music of Chrono Trigger, I don't think we know for sure. We'd probably have to examine, you know, what he was working on previously. as far as sort of maybe prototypical music for the game. But Uematsu then famously came in and finished a couple tracks for the game. But it is one of those soundtracks that I think, given the project's limitations of the Super Nintendo and the scale that of a soundtrack that you could afford on a cartridge, it's incredible what was accomplished.
Yeah, no, it's a similar thing. I get the sense, at least on Xenogears, there's not enough tracks really to have a different, you know, feel to some of the scenes that really should have had their own, at least some kind of variation on the music. But it's still, I think, one of the great, you know, video game soundtracks. And the there was a recent like 20-year anniversary concert that you can, if you're lucky, you can find on YouTube somewhere. They seem to be taking it down too, because they're trying to sell copies of this thing still. It's just amazing. And he's returned to these songs a few times. He did a compilation with a band called Millennial Fair, right? So there's your Chrono Trigger connection. And it's a CD called Creed. It's spelled Creid. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it, but it's just beautiful music by any objective standard, right? And and it's that much more, you know, because I whenever I hear those songs, right, I go back to the events and the things that go with them for me. I think that music has that kind of haunting quality that, and this is something, so maybe just now in our culture, we're sort of grappling with the ways that the artistry and the total dedication that it takes to make great art, the toll that those can take on somebody, and the ways that those can be connected with, you know, physical or psychologically damaging habits and, you know, potentially addictions even. I think, you know, for a long time we've known like artists are a little off. They do their own thing, and they do some dangerous things sometimes too. But just now, I think maybe we're sort of starting to wonder if is that worth it anymore? And that's kind of a new thing, I think.
Yeah. What is the age old phrase? Art is suffering, right?
Yeah.
I think there's something almost that sounds pretentious to our 21st century ears when we hear a phrase like that. But certainly art has taken its toll on its artists throughout history. And there's been various artists that have even died for their art. Depends on your definition of art too, which is a whole other subject that I try to grapple with people on. I'm very, as a side note, I'm very against the idea that everything is art. Because I think once you sap all of the meaning of out of the word art, it becomes meaningless. It becomes a nonsense term. It becomes useless. Yes. Now, that being said, I think there's a whole bunch of things that are art, that are crafts, that are ways of appreciating various skills. But I think at base, you need an artist and you need intentional expression. But anyway, yeah. All that to say, I think that what we see a lot, especially, it seems previously, especially with Japanese game developers, was a lot of suffering. What we see today a lot of, too, is a lot of suffering for the creation of video games as art. Whether they think of it as an art form or not in development is something that I'd be very interested to know. I think that there are certain games that seem as if they're produced more as consumer products than as art forms. But I think that there are certain things which are just going to be art regardless, because they include certain things like writing, music, visuals. You've got very few video games that aren't going to use those things at all. Well, maybe even... that's impossible. Video games. How do you have a video game without video? So,
yeah. I don't know. Yeah. In many ways, the game incorporates and tries to strike some kind of balance between a lot of other older forms of art, right? And So how could the amalgamation of all of those things not be its own complex and wonderful thing to critique and analyze endlessly?
Right, and that's a good point, right? And I've had that discussion with some other folks as well. You know, some folks will say, and it's an interesting argument, right? So some folks will say video games are not an art form, and they'll typically come at it as, you know, the whole because there's art is everything and nothing, or because it's too soon to decide, and because the term art carries a lot of connotations with it that don't fit or don't do service to the fact that video games are so unique. But then I'll ask those folks, okay, do you think that like novels are a work of art? Yes. Do you think that paintings are a work of art? Yes. Do you think that movies are a work of art? Yes. Do you think that music is an art form rather? Yes. Okay. Well, video games include still images, painting, a lot of, cinematic tendencies, especially today. They include a lot of music and they include a lot of writing. I mean, right now I'm playing Final Fantasy 14. There's a lot of dialogue in that game. And it either has to be poorly written or crudely written. So I think that again, we're still kind of looking at what are video games exactly? How are they an art form? And what do we say about them that's unique? Maybe the most interesting argument I saw for games not being art was from, and I mentioned this on a previous episode of my show, so I'm not going to go on for it too long, but somebody I was able to interview said that video games are not art because they're so unique. And that element of uniqueness, I think, still needs to be explored.
No, yeah, I see the value of a lot of those kinds of distinctions, right? And, you know, I don't know if it's fair to call a game a work of art in the way that some of the components of that game could be, right? If you took a photo of somebody, you know, making a beautiful play in, I don't know, in tennis or whatever, right? That photograph might be easier to identify as art than the game itself, which has elements of competition and, you know, physical prowess and all that right. sort of stuff that's really hard to just kind of objectively look at aesthetically or whatever. So, yeah, but at the same time, I mean, I think that there is it goes to a really deep question, right? That what is question and distinguishing elements of difference within sort of realms of overlap. There's a lot that rides on, you know, the language and the categories of thought that you're applying, and I don't know that, you know, festering difficulties like that will necessarily get us closer to, you know, appreciating and understanding the thing when you get down to it. But I do really like, yeah, thinking about these kind of things. Here's one way I like to think about them. When the developer seems self-aware and, you know, to an extent pretentious maybe about their own artistry, I think that you see that more, or at least the way that I play games, maybe I just play more RPGs. So I see it more in RPGs where, like, you know, the language is reaching for something, you know, very majestic or you know, impactful or whatever, and the kinds of themes of romance and adventure and stuff are all very grand. And I think, you know, a lot of times they do a nice job of also injecting enough like humor and comic relief to you know, make fun of themselves a little bit at least. But I do feel like, you know, the people making these games, though they do want to, you know, make money and they have to, you know, sell a lot of copies, they do, or did, I guess I don't play a lot of current games, but they did, at least, you know, in the golden age, right, of Square, they really thought of it as art. You see that in a Final Fantasy VII, right, or VI even, or a Xenogears, right? They're really cinematic and and awesome, and they're lush. You know, every quality that you could put into great art is totally present there.
Yeah, I think a mark of great art is, especially the storytelling arts, is great characters that seem to live, that seem to not just inhabit their world but haunt us in ours, that are unforgettable. And certainly there are a lot of those kinds of characters in games. But I think another difficulty too in talking about art even is, you know, we've little agreement on descriptors and definitions of terms. You know, if we're talking with people that don't even think art actually exists, that's one thing. But I tend to use terms like work of art and then art form, that would be really similar to each other, but I think really do have a variety of different meanings. And so I think that calling video games, I wouldn't call video games a work of art, meaning that, you know, they're all masterpieces and they're all incredible. There are a lot of really great games. There are a lot of really rubbish games. But I would call video games an art form in that they all come out as a result of human expression from an artist. So unless you've got any video games that are made by machines, which I don't think we're there yet. Hopefully.
The example of a game that we've both played that takes on some of these heavy theological, philosophical, metaphysical, aesthetic kind of issues, right? Might be Final Fantasy VII, right? Is that one fresh in your mind?
It's always fresh in my mind.
Yeah. When did you last replay it?
So not in its entirety, but I played it the end of last year on the Switch. Nice. I played it a little bit with my wife, and we just dropped off. We kind of lost track, which happens. So
yeah, no, it's a long one. I replayed it with a friend of mine to basically talk through it, you know, and in our long-winded way, maybe a year or two ago now. Yeah, and so it still haunts. Like everyone who's played that game, I feel like, what, for good or for ill, they're marked by it, and it occupies a strange kind of threshold in the series and in, you know, the technology. You know, famously it was going to be on Nintendo, but Nintendo was going to do cartridges, so they couldn't fit the game on, you know, they'd have like 10 cartridges or something. And so they shipped it over to the nefarious PlayStation, right? And so you have the console wars, you know, going strong at that point. And but anyway, so they, you know, the technology really strongly, you know, impacts how people feel about the game from the get-go, and the graphics are just on another level from anything that's really been seen before at that time. Those kind of cinematic qualities of, you know, seeing Midgar for the first time and seeing the characters Aeris and Cloud and all of them, you know, in their full you know, CGI glory, and so it's interesting, I think, that the game also, with all of that going on, also tries to tackle like the deepest issues. You know, you're saving the world like you do in any game, of course, but somehow it's different because you've got a character that's called Jehovah. It's essentially a stand-in for the Yahweh or Jehovah character of the Old Testament. They're, you know, summoning meteor down to okay, so we're spoiling the game now, sorry. But so, you know, there's all kinds of crazy stuff going on in that game. And as a kid playing it, I mean, that's maybe your first encounter with some of that stuff. If you've read the Bible or gone to Sunday school or whatever, you've probably, you know, heard it sort of echoes with some weight for you, but you might never have really thought about theological issues before, or really like encountered mortality, right? Until Aeris is famously killed off in, you know, the third of the way through the game or whatever. So there's a lot to that game that gets at some of these issues of a human and divine relationships that I find to be the kinds of things that art is uniquely positioned to portray and question. And so I think, you know, again, a game with its flaws, but one that I don't know how I would have really encountered some of those ideas without it. Could you just, like, when you think about that game and you think about it objectively and subjectively, what kinds of tensions do you come up against there, and what kinds of things did you learn from that game over the years?
Oh man, easy questions, huh, Wes?
Sorry,
no, that's all good. I love this. So yeah, Final Fantasy VII, I think, is one of those games that that some people are tired of hearing about. It's at that level of fame. So I think that's a layer that you have to kind of cut through to even discuss it. And then I think there's an issue of realizing that critical consensus perhaps takes years to develop as an experience like Final Fantasy kind of settles with people. What we've seen over time with Final Fantasy VII, though, is an expansion of its universe, which in my view has not necessarily detrimentally affected the overall portrayal of this universe, but has changed it at least. I think that, you know, there's a sort of a snarky phrase I like to use every once in a while, the animeification of things.
Sure.
And I think that it's something that we've seen even in just the disparity between things like tone and presentation, between Final Fantasy VII and Advent Children. I think that those are very different things, even though they happen to take place in the same universe. So there's that element. That for me would be, I think, probably a subjective way to approach the original Final Fantasy VII in light of my awareness of the continued development of this universe. And that certainly that's extraneous to any quality that exists in the original seven itself, because that's all there was. Then they made just that. I don't think that they made seven with Advent Children in mind, for instance. But I think within seven itself, there are, you know, there's typos, there's glitches, there are things where the design doesn't function as intended. There's a lot of quality of life things that could have been implemented. So I don't think that 7 is a perfect game, but I don't think that it needs to necessarily be a perfect game. This is perhaps something that I ought to say more frequently. It's perhaps something that that people assume when you mention things like objectivity or when you champion objectivity in games. I don't think anything is 100% objective in art. I don't know that it can be. It might be, but who knows? But I'm interested in exploring, again, both avenues, objective and subjective. So Seven, I think, though, on a subjective level, is a game that means a ton to a lot of people, simply because of the era that it came out in. You know, people my age were playing Final Fantasy VII, and were just like, everybody in my school was playing Final Fantasy VII. Doesn't matter who you were, you were playing it at home, and then we would get together and talk about it the next day. I actually had Aerith's death spoiled contemporaneously because somebody in the schoolyard told me. But the degree to which spoilers matter to somebody, I think, is also subjective. Yeah. But it was still an impactful moment. So, but yeah, Seven is one of those games that I think is timeless in a lot of ways. It continues to be fascinating. It is, as many Final Fantasy games are, immensely rich with historical and mythological reference.
Yes. Yes, I certainly agree. I have to confess, I've never played any of the spin-off or sequel or prequel or whatever games. I really just know the original Final Fantasy VII, and I don't know if I'll even play the remake when it finally comes out. I might not be that interested in it, honestly, because unless they do something, you know, that is as spectacular for today as the game was when it first came out. I probably would just rather, you know, read about it at this point. But but I think, so here's my pitch to you about Xenogears is that, you know, as astonishing, as groundbreaking as Final Fantasy VII was at the time, I think that Xenogears is to Final Fantasy VII as Final Fantasy VII was to, I don't know, whatever other great game had come before it. It's in terms of the density and the complexity of the kind of story that Xenogears is trying to tell. It is an order of magnitude beyond, and that goes for the kind of in your face theological stuff that's in that game as well. It was taking place, the development of that game was taking place at the same time as Final Fantasy VII, and I believe that some of the issues that the Xenogears developers had was a direct result of having to compete with the flagship, you know, series for attention and time and resources within Square at the time. So they have this kind of weird like evil twin relationship with one another. I'm not sure which one is the good twin and which one's the evil twin in this scenario, but they certainly are interesting counterparts. So for anyone out there who's not played it, if you like Final Fantasy VII, you probably will be interested in checking out Xenogears. And I wanted to turn then to some of the questions that you got from people just today, right? So these are some pretty active followers you've got.
Yeah, there's a couple folks that, especially if I tag them, be like, hey, I was like poking somebody, like, I need your feedback like now. So yeah. But there are some really great people out there. Something that I think works directly into what you were just talking about Xenogears handling of these questions in a very in-your-face sort of way. Yeah. So my perspective on this has kind of changed over the course of my life. And I see that in the two philosophies of Tolkien and Lewis, famously contemporary writers knew each other. Lewis apparently believed, and I don't have a source for this off the top of my head, so I apologize. You're so well-read, actually, that you might actually know where these statements come from.
I'm so glad that you brought Lewis and Tolkien. I'd been meaning to get around to them, so thank you.
Oh, yeah. Hey, you're welcome. Look at that. But Lewis' perspective was sort of that fiction can and should portray theological ideas in a way that's through analogy or through metaphor. And of course Lewis is perhaps most famous for his Chronicles of Narnia, in which religious themes are unmissable. There's no way that you could read Narnia without picking up on those things. I think he actually, in Last Battle, he even like just sits the reader down and explains, like, oh, this is this, like, Aslan is Christ just by a different name. So, like, he was very much in tune with using these ideas as, again, perhaps we could say in your face metaphors. With Tolkien, apparently, and this is something they disagreed on, Tolkien believed that those things should be much more subtle, that they should be sort of more background. And I've had various friends that believe various things. I've had people say to me that you should, you shouldn't include God in your fiction. And then I've heard others that, you know, sort of lean more toward the level of, you know, fiction should be, I think this was C.S. Lewis' term, smuggling ideas in. Nice. But I don't know exactly where I stand now. I think that art as propaganda is the extreme take from Lewis. I don't think that he actually believed that, you know, Narnia was propaganda, but certainly there are creative works out there that don't serve any other purpose other than smuggling ideas in, which I think is wrong. But then on the other extreme, I don't think that I don't think that these questions are taboo in fiction. I think that it's fine to talk about these things. I mean, there are people that can get offended in discussing these things, and I want to be aware of that. But I don't think it's wrong to include those things in, say, your works of fiction. So there was a question here. This is from Ancient Lit Dude, who said, okay, I don't know the Zeno series too well, but my general question would be, why is religion usually treated so critically and unoriginally in video games? Why don't writers take the time to form nuanced questions of faith in games? In response to him, Amiibo MD said, fear of backlash, I suppose. So I think that's probably, again, that hinting at the more Tolkien perspective of like, hey, you don't mention these things in games because people are going to be offended at the portrayal of them. And that was more me at a younger age. If I encountered questions like this in games and things like doubts and things like that would kind of rile me up. But today I think that it's good to actually express those questions from whatever perspective you come at them in fiction. So plus I think that video games get enough backlash as it is without, you know, religious backlash. Religious backlash was kind of a thing of the, you know, the early days of video games. I don't hear too much about that anymore. So I don't know.
Yeah. It's interesting how in this question, I think, in my experience, I found that, like I said, these games were some of my first things that made me think about religious topics in a serious way, actually. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there isn't that much harm in something being really obvious and in your face if the person that it's in the face of doesn't know about them at all, really. Mm-hmm. They need that, right? And I think, you know, Lewis has a point, you know, writing books like that for kids. It's all well and good if you're a kid reading it and you don't know what's going on and it's like sort of new to you, then it's mm-hmm. interesting. But if you read it, you know, as a grown up, of course, knowing a lot of stuff about Christianity or whether you find it pretty offensively, you know, dogmatic or like too
like trite, maybe, huh?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And so I think that those are two valid issues, and a lot of it comes down to the audience. Like I say, for me, this was the start of a really deepening of my thinking about religion. And I think of all the games that tackle religious themes, Xenogears does it in with the greatest complexity. As much as it is sort of in your face a lot of the time throughout the game, you're getting a lot of stuff that is not making a lot of sense because it's just sort of like drawing on some big words and, you know, these weighty topics from just taken wholesale out of myth and religion, psychology, whatever. It does come together. Like, it does. if you give it a chance, if you stick with it, and the way that it does it is through these characters who have a great amount of development. And I think, you know, not to, you know, demean other games or anything, but, you know, other games characters are a lot of times are sort of just caricatures. They're just mm-hmm. sort of stand-ins, and that's all you need, right, for the yeah. game to work. It's great. It works nicely because you can sort of project yourself onto them in lots of ways. But these are truly, I think, you know, truly nuanced characters, and so the ways that the material is handled through their story comes out to be worth the time and effort and occasional headaches. And I can't be too much more specific than that. Unfortunately, I'm still working my way through the game for the first time in a long time. And so I would just say, like, if you're interested in, you know, reading deeply into religious stuff, there's few games that do as much with it as Xenogears.
Yeah. I mean, if that pitch doesn't work on me, it's not going to work on anybody, but that pitch definitely works on me. So it's moved higher up my someday list. I can tell you that.
Rock on.
But what did you, you know, what, this is something I've talked about before. I don't know if it's something that I've heard from you before, but the question about, is religion usually treated critically and unoriginally in video games?
Well, it's a hard one because the kinds of stories that religions and myths tell are not original, right? By our kind of modern standards, they're not meant to be. They're meant to be the essentials of the story, right? That are sort of distilled down. And so I think I know what the question is really asking. It's like, why are they so unhelpful for thinking through like religious topics or something like that, right? Why don't they really shed light on deeper truths or something in the way that a great novel or a great symphony or whatever, would do? But I think, they're often there just to support the gameplay, and that's all they need to do. Whereas in Xenogears, they are really integral to the character development, the kind of story they're interested in telling, with its sweeping scope and all that. It needs to have the death of God as an essential story point. That's not just like the final boss has to be like big and scary and angelic in some way, right? I don't know. What do you think? I know that Nintendo had lots of problems with representing religion at all for a long time. So there's some issues there.
Yeah, and that was actually brought up by Black Mage Felix too. Do you think Nintendo was overly sensitive about religion in early NES releases, or was it a good idea at the time to keep it out? I think there was a different time back then, but we saw things like something as simple as the Red Cross removed from the hospital buildings in Earthbound.
Yes,
it seems
example.
A little silly, like pretty silly. How long has the Red Cross organization been around in the West? Probably longer than Earthbound, I think.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think it depends on their perspective and what they thought American audiences were ready for, but I think times have totally changed from that. As far as Jordan's question about religion being treated critically or unoriginally, that's a tendency that I have to think about portrayals of religion in video games. But I think that at large, that's a typical portrayal in modern storytelling. I think there's a lot of disillusionment, like real disillusionment with organized religion in particular. And a lot of real sort of wrestling with tremendous questions like, biogenesis and the origins of the universe and meaning of life and so on and so forth. And so I think that comes out in a lot of games. But I think there are other games too that sort of just rely on the weight of those questions to carry the game, but that doesn't always pay off. So I think that generally we do actually see religion portrayed, maybe not negatively, but perhaps in an oversimplified sense. So a couple of games that came to mind actually just now was Bloodstained: Ritual of the Night has a pretty negative portrayal of organized religion. And this is all under the very fair admission that organized religion has been pretty awful throughout history. So, there's definitely terrible things that have been done in the name of various religions. At the same time, I think that there's a lot of good things that have been done by either religious bodies or by people with religious ideas. And so it depends on perhaps where you fall on the question of, is religion a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah.
But I think in JRPGs in particular, and this kind of hinges into another question here that we got from a good man. Why is it, do you think, that organized religion, particularly with a Judeo-Christian bent, is portrayed as ultimately evil in Japanese games? Wonder if it has to do with the opening of Japan in the mid-1800s by Westerners myself, but I digress. That's a theory that I've kind of been working through. I haven't done much research on it, but I think that in Japanese games, it seems like there's a distrust of Western organized religion in a lot of ways, and that's perhaps influenced the development of these ideas even in Western games, because a lot of us grew up on Japanese games. Another Japanese game that comes to mind that has distrust for organized religion is Breath of Fire 2, which is one that I mention a lot when religion in games comes up. Is that one that you've played?
No, I played one of the Breath of Fire games. I don't remember which one it was. A friend of mine lent it to me, and I didn't get that far in it, honestly.
Okay.
So it's not one I'm as familiar with. No, is it the big bad in the game though, or is it like a minor enemy that you roll through?
It kind of is a very typical, functions in a very typical way for JRPGs. So you discover that this organized religious body is actually worshiping demons and not God. And their goals are not humanitarian. Their goals are to, bring the final boss to the surface of the world and so on and so forth.
There you go.
So... But an interesting thing about Breath of Fire 2 is you spend a lot of time in churches, actually, in Breath of Fire 2. But there's a character, and I wrote about this before, there's a character named Ray, who is what you would think like a saint would be from this church, the Church of St. Eva, I think it was. But anyway, he's one that's distinct and separate. Despite being a part of this organization, he's distinct and separate from its principles of worshiping demons. So he stands in opposition to the party, but at the same time, you kind of develop this empathy for the character, and he develops an understanding of your perspective as well. So I think that that's illustrative of the fact that bodies and groups are one thing, but individuals are another thing. And I think that's really important in any discussion about religion.
Oh, yeah. And I like the cultural consideration, that the historical one, the way that a culture thinks about itself is not necessarily the way that it's perceived by a different, its neighbors or someone far away. And that's really, crucial, I think. And so I can't say for sure. I don't know enough about, Japanese history and what missionaries were doing there and what they thought of it. But it does make sense to me that, when you, from within a worldview that accounts for spiritual powers, when you see people coming in and claiming to speak in the name of those powers and then, doing a lot of hypocritical stuff, actually, then maybe they are enthralled to those powers, and those powers aren't as good as they think they are, or something like that, right? So, I think that there's tons of examples of that. It's a perceptive question, I guess I just ultimately am saying I don't know. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's a fair answer. I was just gonna say that growing up in Hawaii, there is an interesting relationship between missionaries and Hawaiians that has played out in various different ways. Yeah. There are heinous things that have been done in the name of religion, even in that Hawaiian context, and there are very good things that have been done, and typically that comes down again to the individuals. One of the most perceptive statements I've ever seen on this idea that I've just expressed actually comes from Charles Dickens. Recently,
right on.
Well, obviously it was, Christmas recently. And I just read A Christmas Carol. It was a book that I was like, I'm pretty sure I've read that at some point in my life. And then I was like, wait, have I ever sat down and read A Christmas Carol? And it dawned on me that I probably hadn't. So I sat down and read it and was just re-fell in love with Dickens. One of my favorite writers, Tale of Two Cities is one of my favorite books ever. Mm-hmm. Just, You know, it's almost like the elegance of the English language has been lost for the sake of the efficiency of the modern era. Right. We can't talk like, I mean, imagine if everybody talked like Dickens. You couldn't use Twitter.
There's just well, what no a way. Shame.
Yeah, what a shame. He said, yeah, there's a perhaps a kind of utility there. But social media as we know it, memes wouldn't exist. Imagine memes with like hundreds of words to express a single idea. But anyhow, in A Christmas Carol, there's, you know, the scene where Scrooge is being haunted by the ghost of Christmas Present. And they're going around the city and sort of seeing what's happening around this Christmas time. And Scrooge looks at the ghost and complains. So it says, "Spirit," said Scrooge after a moment's thought, "I wonder you of all things in the many worlds about us should desire to cramp these people's opportunities of innocent enjoyment." "I," cried the spirit. Scrooge says, "You would deprive them of their means of dining every seventh day, often the only day on which they can be said to dine at all, wouldn't you?" "I," cried the spirit. "You seek to close those places on the seventh day," said Scrooge, "and it comes to the same thing." "I seek," exclaimed the spirit. "Forgive me if I am wrong. It has been done in your name, and at least in that of your family," said Scrooge. "There are some upon this earth of yours," returned the spirit, "who lay claim to know us, and who do their deeds of passion, pride, ill will, hatred, envy, bigotry, and selfishness in our name, who are as strange to us and all our kith and kin as if they had never lived. Remember that and charge their doings on themselves and not us." And I was just like, and that's wonderful. it's such a great observation, because it demonstrates that thing that people could adopt any name superficially and do things under a banner, under a title. But whether they actually match the principles and the core ideas of that name is another thing entirely. And so I think that a lot of terrible things have been done in the name of Christ, who himself said, you know, "Those who live by the sword will die by the sword." Hmm. Who told Peter to put his sword away, that are completely contrary to what the principles of the New Testament actually are.
Just to quickly follow on that, I agree. And I think a big part of that is as simple as people not reading the books, right? Like if you get it all secondhand, as great as your, you know, version of A Christmas Carol was, it made you think you'd actually read the original, but you've got to read the original, man. It's so good.
I bet it's good.
Yeah. Or the Bible for that matter.
Yeah. Well, and the Bible is one of those, I mean, the book's been around for several thousand years, quite a long time. And a lot of its ideas have entered popular culture. And I think once they enter that kind of quick transmission, sort of a meme level of transmission, there's a level of corruption that takes place through that transmission. And so, you know, you have things that, you know, people are like, "Yeah, the Bible says God helps those who help themselves." Like, really, where does it actually say that? Is it even a principle that's in there? You know, so things like that. I think that there's value in reading a variety of source materials and kind of figuring out what your own perspective on these things are.
Yeah. Yeah, I started reading the Bible around the time I was playing Xenogears. So I was like, I've got to, like, actually read this book.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's pretty great if Xenogears convinced you to read a 2,000-year-old religious text. There's a, you know, there, that sort of was my experience with Breath of Fire 2.
Cool.
That it provoked me to, because I grew up with my family taking me to church, slowly developed into an atheist around when my parents were divorced, played Breath of Fire 2 and was horrified at the suggestion that never occurred to my mind that they could actually be worshiping evil. Even though, you know, the church in Breath of Fire 2 is not Christian, it's obviously something that's based on westernized Judeo-Christian sort of ideas. But I think there are a lot of ideas that are presented in games. Some things that came to mind were like Xenoblade Chronicles 2 sort of wrestles with the Odyssey. Horizon Zero Dawn sort of has themes of traditions and superstitions. Biogenesis. Journey is a game that to me is very much about this concept of the numinous. Final Fantasy Tactics, very much centered on manuscript evidence and the importance of evidence for claims being made about certain religious beliefs. Final Fantasy X has religion, you know, front and center, and I think sort of presents religion as like an opiate of the masses. But I think that 10 goes a long way to sort of redeem central ideas too. So yeah, I think that there's a lot to explore in games. I think that some games do it better than others in discussing religious ideas. Yeah. Some of them, again, seem like they're just using them for the sake of the weight. And some of them are doing them in an actual interesting way. So,
yeah. Of all those games you just mentioned, I am only familiar with the Final Fantasies. I'm sorry.
Hey, that's all right. There's a lot of games and nobody can play all of them. So there's not much you can do. Well, like the Xenoblade Chronicles 2 went, Theodicy, which is sort of the concept of vindicating God in light of the existence of evil.
Milton, the ways of God is to justify the ways of God to man.
There you go.
Paradise Lost. Yeah.
Oh man. And I was, you just reminded me, I was reading Paradise Lost in the middle of last year and I forgot about it. I think it got buried under another pile of books. So I'm going to have to dig it out and finish it. But a big question in that game was, there's this figure called the Architect that lives in, you know, this, I think it was called Elysium, but it's very much like a Garden of Eden kind of a concept, and returning there. There's a lot of Milton, I think, in Xenoblade Chronicles 2, and characters asking, you know, why are we made this way? Why have we been made this way? Why is life this way? Why do things have to happen this way? And so let's go and ask the Architect. Now the game, spoilers, the game kind of cheats you of an answer by just making the Architect a fallible human, which is like, well, then it's not really a question at that point, right?
It just moves it back a step, yeah.
Right. So I was like, well, darn it, because this is such a fascinating question, at least to me. So I was a little disappointed by that answer, and that's a subject of disappointment that I had with that game. But it's interesting to see a question like that come up. And that, you know, I mean, that's been around since the Old Testament. Shall the axe say against him who hews with it, why are you using me thus, or something like that? So question of like, why, asking God, why have I been made this way? Super fascinating in Xenoblade Chronicles 2, but ultimately they kind of, you know, pull the rug out from under you.
Yeah. All right. How about some of these other questions they've sent us here? What do we see? Someone says, Ceramics. Oh, that's a nice name. I can't think of a single game that warrants a sequel or HD remaster remake more than Xenogears. Yeah. I'm on the fence about that kind of stuff. Like I said, I kind of just like the original games. I don't play a lot of new games, I have to say. I liked the Link's Awakening remake. That was delightful.
Uh-huh.
But generally, I don't really go for them. And so, you know, I'd be curious to see it. The way that I like to think about games is like, if you want to remaster, remake it, just like write a fanfic or do a long form podcast about it. That's how I get my imaginative dose of Xenogears.
Yeah. I prefer a remaster over a remake any day. I think a remaster is more authentic and accurate to the source material, if you like. Whereas a remake sort of is potentially going to take more liberties, and that's certainly what we're seeing with the Final Fantasy VII remake, which insist is going to be a very different game. Now, the good thing is the original will always exist.
Amen.
You know, even if Square decides to I don't know, pull all digital copies of Seven off the market, you'll still be able to get it and play it and through various means. But I think that they're definitely pursuing a very different kind of game. That being said, for Xenogears, I would definitely be on fence, or on the fence. I would definitely be on board, rather, for an HD remaster. And the point there being just the accessibility of the software. I like to collect. Right now, I'm kind of focusing on collecting PlayStation 1 games. But some PlayStation 1 games can get really pricey. Mm. Insanely mm-hmm. pricey. Mm-hmm. I sold a PS1 game for over $400. The Misadventures of Tron Bond, because to me, like, no game is worth $400. Like, I'm just flat out, like, is this going to sit on my shelf? I'll maybe play it once in 10 years, or I can have $400. Like, I'll take the $400. Thank you very much. So Xenogears, I think, is probably well up there in terms of price and buying the hard copy. Now, I think you could probably find it digitally, on PSN, maybe PS3 or PS4, I don't know, probably PS3. But to make it more accessible, an HD remaster would be great, so long as they preserve the original content. So yeah. That's my thoughts on that.
Yeah, I want it warts and all. Like, yeah, I want to know what the game was.
It's interesting, yeah. It's interesting when they don't fix things in remasters. And I want to say I played something like that last year where I was kind of like shocked that they didn't fix something. Gosh, I can't remember what it was, but at the same time, it's like leaving those things in there preserves the fact that this was a product that was created with flaws, and those flaws, can be nostalgic to some people.
Yeah.
You know, what is that typo, in Midgar, the guy that, there's a guy that's sick. You mentioned it in your column, right?
Oh,
the guy
outside,
this guy are sick.
Yeah, this guy are sick.
Yeah, which certainly has like a almost like a memeific level of enjoyment to it.
Oh yeah.
And so maybe they won't change that in the Final Fantasy VII remake, and that'll be hilarious.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Now there's a question here that would be hugely spoilerific, which is my only question from the War in Our Star, Wonder of Time, about Xenogears has always been, what the hell happened in the intro movie, and WTF does it have to do with the game? Fair question. Like,
I had the same question.
You don't know anything about that for many, many hours of the game. And the way that the game lets you into some of those mysteries is very frustratingly, I don't know, slow. I don't know. And not that clear. So it takes a lot of work to figure out WTH happened and WTF doesn't have to do with anything. But it does. It's worth it. I don't know if the mystery contributes in some way to like helping you get through some of the other stuff that's weird about the game. For me anyway, the kind of player that I am, the kind of person I am, I want to know, like you, what happened. And so I'm willing to go through a lot of other stuff to figure that out. And it does come out piece by piece, and it's like very ominous and very, I thought, very effective, actually. It's a little silly, yes, and a little bit bizarre, but it comes together. Yeah, it's worth it.
And I think games weren't afraid to take their time, too, with a bit of storytelling back then. I've played a couple more recent games that are humongous, 100-hour games, but the story part will be like a 20-hour game. Yeah. Everything else is, you know, running around back and forth, and systems and quests and so on and so forth. The sort of the gamey aspect of those games.
Gotcha.
So it's interesting that, you know, you go back to some of those older JRPGs, and sometimes I'll ask, like, what side quests are in this game, you know? And sometimes there'll be none. It'll just be like all story, all linear story for the entire game. And that story will take its time too. So
Xenogears is, yeah, very light on gameplay after a certain point, very heavy on linear exposition of story that you've been waiting hours to get. So I hope you like it.
Well, I will have to let you know when I finally get around to playing it. So I've been building up too much of a backlog. That's a problem.
The clouds and bushes have faces on them in Super Mario Brothers, the greatest game ever, Mario 3, I assume. What does it mean? Yeah. I think that, you know, there is a spirit that moves through all things, right? And that's one way of seeing it smiling at you.
There you go. See, I read that as less a serious question than a joking question. So I just said anthropomorphize everything. And there's a weird tendency. We were watching a National Geographic quasi-documentary series called Year Million that's just about future ideas. We're talking about AI and robots and making sure that the robots look like us. So that we can relate to them. And there's a part of me that's like, no, just make it a voice box. I can relate to a voice box. Make it an animal. Just don't make it a human. Because the second that you can't tell if it's a human or a robot, you're at Blade Runner. And I don't necessarily want to live in that universe. But I think that there's a very natural tendency somehow of human beings to anthropomorphize everything. We do it to our pets constantly. We do it to inanimate objects. Will be driving by a building, you're like, it looks like a face. But your brain did that before you even said those words. So I don't know. But yeah, we put cloud faces on clouds rather and faces on hills in Super Mario.
Yeah. And Critz McCritz had trouble getting into Xenogears. What do I think made it unique and interesting compared to its RPG peers? And it sounds like maybe you did try playing it at one point and had trouble getting into it as well. Or stuff came up?
Yeah, I think I played it on an emulator, and this must have been years and years ago. So it just didn't run well. It was on my first desktop that I ever bought with my own money. Gosh, must have been in 2000 or 2002 or something like that. So it was a long time ago, and PS1 emulators just were not good, at least none that I found. So it barely ran that intro. Starting to play the game, everything was just off kilter. So I didn't get much further. I've never owned the game. You know, my stance on emulation has changed a little bit over time. But I like to collect now. And so if I could get a hold of the game, either digitally or physically, it'd be something I'd be very interested to play.
I think it is... by whatever means you can play it, you want to at this point, right? So
I will go and rob my local retro store and sell them that Wesley Shantz said I could, yes, by any means necessary, play this game.
I also emulating, that's a tricky moral quandary right there. But I would send you my copy of this game so you can play it. How about that?
Oh, no. That's not, it's very, very kind of you, but I'm sure I can find it, you know, on the PlayStation Network. It's probably on the PS3, all right, PSN. And I'll get to it someday. There's a lot of kind people like yourself who really want me to play certain games, and they'll offer to send me a copy. I'm like, I just have too many games to play. That's my problem fundamentally. I just have too many games to play. And it's a great first world problem to have. But man, it's like trying to navigate the infinite progression. You don't know where to start. There's no end. Yes. You can't go from day one to day two. It's all infinite.
You can try to play, right, like the canon of games or something like that, right? Like the best games or something. But maybe it's better just to go with a kind of one game leads you to another sort of thing, and be serendipitous about it, and let the chips fall where they may kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I hope that, you know, in the course of this couple of hours, we've answered that question, though, about what makes it interesting. There's also a lot of great... All right, so this is the last comment I want to read, which is from Kazena, which is a quote from the game. Want to hear some hot sounds I recorded? Yeah, there's a lot of great podcasts out there. This is one that's used frequently almost as a catchphrase by one of the podcasts that I listen to these days, which is Retrograde Amnesia is the name of it. And it's all about Xenogears. It's wonderful. So yes, the answer to that is yes. And there's also a few like real good YouTube sort of video analyses that are really nicely produced that do go into like, you know, more spoilers and laying out some stuff about the story that helped it make sense for you if you just want that up front, you know? And so, yeah, there's endless depths to this game. It's something that's given me tremendous food for thought over the years and is really standing up to my scrutiny now that I'm coming back around to it. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to chat about it with me when you've never even played it. That's so wonderful. Wonderful conversation.
I've really enjoyed this conversation, and thank you so much for the invitation to your show. I've wanted to talk to you like this for a while, and I'll have to definitely have you on MageCast sometime.
Cool.
Maybe we'll talk about a game you've never played before.
It's only fair.
No, just kidding. I think we did one or two episodes of MageCast on a game I've never played before. And it's interesting. It's fun because you can still talk contextually. And sometimes those contextual conversations are just as important. You know, we've talked about a variety of other games that sort of fit in the same contexts. And it's good. It's great. As long as you enjoy the conversation, nobody's feelings were hurt, things were said, beliefs were expressed, art was defined.
I hope it get some feedback and more questions, and that the conversation goes on. That would be the best outcome, I think.
Yes, that's certainly what our civilization needs, is more conversation, less echo chamber.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again. Take care.
Fantastic. I really enjoy open and honest discussions like that on big questions, when it doesn't boil down to shouting or name calling. It is possible, folks. For more from Bookworm Games, don't forget to check out the link in the description. Thank you to everyone who shared their thoughts and questions, and I'm very sorry we didn't get to all of them. If you have any particular thoughts and further questions for us about these subjects, you can reach out on Twitter, find me at TheWellReadMage, or by email, TheWellReadMage@gmail.com. We're very far from experts, we're just people interested in the discussion. This episode may be over, but the legend will live on, passed down by the dwarves, the elves, and the dragons.
Hi, my name is Roger Reichert, host of the Dialogue Tree podcast, your source for interviews with creators within the video game industry. Join me as I interview people within the gaming industry and learn about their story and share those stories with you. New episodes will release every other Thursday on iTunes, Google Play, Buzzsprout, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us at GamerHeadsPodcast.com. That's the Dialogue Tree Podcast, now part of the Little Fella Media Podcast Network.